I came to Penang. I used to, I majorly practiced in Burma, in the Mahasi centers, with different teachers there. And I'd stay first 1 year, 6 months, 3 months, depending on the visa. And we used to come, the Western monks, after being in Burma or Myanmar, 3, 6, 1 year, we get quite run down. And we used to come here to Penang, to the MBMC, Malaysian Buddhist Meditation Center, and recuperate. We've got very good food, nice food, very good support. So I do appreciate people in Penang who supported us at that time, the Malaysian Buddhist Meditation Center. Right. So what's it all about? Meditation aspects. Okay, the meditation aspects. So where did it all start? With Siddhartha Gautama, the enlightened one, called the Buddha. So in his very first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, the Four Noble Truths. So I don't need to enumerate them, but I will say that the practice path to be free of distress and suffering is, as you would know, the Eightfold Path. And we can break that down into three trainings. Okay? In Pali, Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. So Sila, you know, is one's behavior. One harmonizes one's behavior. One restrains oneself, at least from any expression of that behavior. This evening we're going to focus on is the meditation skill sets, right? The three meditation skills. The first, and it may seem an obvious, a given, is one applies oneself. It is the application and sustained application, which is the first quality that one needs in this practice of meditation. Then the core teaching the Buddha gave, and he said he had only rediscovered an ancient path, was samasati. Sama means right or skilled. Sati. Sati is a key term and an important practice. That means it's been. Sati means presence. Presence of what? Presence of mind or mindfulness. That is the core meditation practice or mental culture in the Buddha's Dharma. And in the very first teaching, the Buddha highlighted that. He emphasized that. It's about mindfulness. You might know in Western psychotherapy, up to recent times, the therapy was cognitive behavior therapy, they called it, cognitive training. CBT. Now, most psychotherapists, if you go, have problems or some traumas you want to work through with them, they will teach you, as a therapeutic tool, mindfulness. The Buddha had said he'd rediscovered this practice, you see. So while mindfulness used in therapy is a healing tool, it is certainly much more than that, much deeper. Because while you get healing, if you in Buddhist practice, you also get transformation. It's transformation of consciousness. That's much more than just healing. Healing, of course, is a byproduct, most definitely. And many people would come to meditation just for healing. But if they pursue the Buddhist practice path, they will find that it's more than just therapy that we're after. The practice is transformation of consciousness, which leads to the purification of mind, which leads to cleansing the mind. So we can point out that in the core teaching that the Buddha gave in his very first teaching, we can say that it is sati, mindfulness, that the Buddha emphasized. Okay. So just to give you to understand what Buddhist practice is about. Oh, thank you. Okay, great. You can understand Buddhist practice by illustrating it through a model of the mind, right? It's just an arbitrary model to explain, it's not actually what the mind is, surely, but to explain what Buddhist practice is. So we can say this model of the mind has three layers. Mm-hmm. There is the hidden or dormant or latent level of the mind, right? Then the next level is where the material in the mind manifests in the mind itself. And then we have the expression of that, of this model. The top level, or the third level, is the expression, which is either in the through speech or actions, right? So this three levels of the mind. The top level is is where we restrain the mind. So if we go back down to the bottom, we find that there's dormant or latent content in the mind. Dormant, maybe unwholesome material in the mind. Okay? And this is analogous to a sleeping snake. I went to the snake temple this morning, had a look around, all the snakes I see, there was no activity at all. They were all sleeping in the snake temple up the road here in Penang. And I didn't want to poke them, but if I'd poked them, I would have stirred them up. See? So there's the snake, or the anger in the mind, or any negative content in the mind, negative emotion, is dormant and not apparent. It's hidden or latent in the mind. So when you poke the snake, when it's activated, it will rise up, the anger in the mind will come up into the manifest level of the mind. The center, middle layer, and the anger will be going round and round in the mind. The anger, the emotion, negative emotion, will be in the mind itself. Okay, now, then the snake strikes. That is, it is either through speech, the anger is expressed level. It's expressed either in speech or action, right? So how does Buddhist practice deal with this? The dormant level, hidden, the manifest, and the expressed. Well, with the manifest, we use precepts and training rules, right? You have 5 or 10 precepts and you restrain oneself. You do not in any circumstance in the Buddha Dharma express the anger. Unlike in Western psychotherapy, you're very much encouraged to express, to do some primal screaming or beat the pillar or, you know, get it out there, right? So express it all. That's the therapy, Western therapy's approach. But in the Buddha Dharma, we inhibit that expression. We take precepts. We do not at any allow ourselves to express it either in words or in any actions. Okay. So we use precepts and training rules. But precepts and training rules are of themselves, especially if they're ritualized, they are not experientially transformative. Okay, they're valuable in that they restrain one, but the content is still there. Uh-huh. And usually it's going round and round. The anger or the negative emotion is in the mind itself. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with that through Buddhist practice? Okay, we use techniques, meditation practices that, if you like, skillful means will suppress that content in the mind. And all the meditation techniques that will do that are based on concentration. Mm-hmm. Fixing the mind on a single object will inhibit any of the material manifest in the mind. Mm-hmm. When one is concentrated, one has achieved some level of concentration, the mind is wholesome. In effect, you've suppressed, but skillfully. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So any concentration-based meditation. One of the better ones, I would say, would be loving-kindness meditation or metta bhavana, because metta bhavana not only fixes the mind to make it one-pointed and therefore stabilizes the mind, but it also adds some sweetener. Uh-huh. So it's somewhat loving-kindness meditation in Western psychotherapy terms is more like an auto-suggestion. Mm-hmm. You're suggesting positive things. Mm-hmm. And you can change the climate of the mind from negative to positive. Uh-huh. So loving-kindness meditation, or in fact any concentration-based meditation, can do the same, have the same benefit. But, and it's a big but, that content is still there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can sit in samatha, we call samatha or serenity meditation, and you induce a state of calm, stability, which is good. And, of course, it has some therapeutic effect. But once the concentration is gone, that's it. You're back to where you are. So, what about the sleeping snake? What about the content that lies in the mind, the negative content that lies dormant, latent in the mind? Huh? We call those kilesas, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay. And anusaya kilesas are what actually, when we get angry or negative, often it's not the actual exchange we might have with people or situation or conditions. It's often some trigger, like you poke the snake, will arise up because you still got a storehouse of material there. Mm-hmm. So, in the teaching the Buddha gave, when he expanded this practice of sati or mindfulness, he gave a set of instructions called the four establishments of mindfulness on the body, the feelings, the mind states, and mental qualities, the qualities of the mind. So these four establishments of mindfulness. And in the preamble to this teaching, in the very first sentence, the Buddha said, the purpose of this practice is essentially for the purification of mind, purification of beings, mm-hmm. cleansing of the mind. Uh-huh. Because without this practice of satipatthana vipassana, of mindfulness, will clear the mind, cleanse the mind. Uh-huh. It will also free the mind of all lamentation and suffering. And it's the way the Buddha said in this text. He said very clearly, this is for the ending of suffering and for the realization of Nibbana, or Nirvana. So this text, and he said, and then he posed a question, how through the practice of these four areas of mindfulness. So it's very important that I just would say, it's my pet hobby horse, if you like. If you're a Buddhist, whatever else you might do to support your practice, or whatever tradition you come from, we'd all agree that the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, is the basic Buddhist teaching, the core teachings. So when we're looking at this, the threefold training or the eightfold path, you know, the basic behavior, harmonizing one's behavior and restraint of the mind. Then we come to the meditation skills, which I've enumerated, application, sustained application, the skilled practice of mindfulness, and I would say the next factor of the three, often said samadhi, I would translate that as intensification of the mindfulness, not some other practice, as often it's often presented. So this intensification will bring wisdom, you know, wisdom, aspiration to realize, and it will lead to right view. Here, right view from a practitioner's point of view is three universal characteristics. These universal characteristics are everything is in change. Everything is change. You will find the meditator will experientially know that everything is impermanent. A meditator, not through theory, but through direct knowing, through the practice, that everything is insubstantial. Nothing, everything in flux, everything changes. So that's number one. And because everything's in change and unsatisfactory, then it is stressful. Unsatisfactory. We call that dukkha. This, it means distress. And we can say stress too. So that's the second universal characteristics of all phenomena. Now, as a practitioner, you will experience not just what you are using now, the content of your mind, but you will see the processes of a body and mind. And these processes of the body and mind are, and it's not very compatible to people, these processes of the mind and body are impersonal. We personalize everything, okay, on one level. But in absolute sense, all we're experiencing are impersonal processes of body and mind. We can say that's anatta. You might have heard that Pali term anatta as non-self, and you can discuss it and argue and you can get very knowledgeable about it, but can you actually experience it? No. Can you understand it? Unless you actually do the practice. So these three universal characteristics are based on only known by through experiential knowledge, not book knowledge, not listening to talks, not second-hand knowledge. Each person, unfortunately, has to do it for themselves. You know, there's no guru in the Buddha Dharma. We have what we call Kalyana Mitta, or a guide, a mentor, but you have to do the work yourself. Unfortunately, that's how it is. With the help, certainly, of somebody who's had travel experience, who has done the practice, him or herself. So, Okay, let's go on to what actually is the practice. I mentioned mindfulness, but really we're looking at what people call meditation. That's a generic term. And I'm just wondering, if I went around and asked you what you understood as meditation, I don't know what I would get. I won't sort of embarrass you or cause you any stress unnecessarily. But anyway, if you go looking in a dictionary definition, you'll find that to meditate means to think about, to ponder, to reflect, to contemplate. Well, you see, it doesn't quite fit what we mean by satipatthana vipassana. Sati means presence, as I've mentioned, or mindfulness, presence of mind. Upatthana means close by, literally, which means being attentive. So satipatthana vipassana, which is actually the key term, satipatthana vipassana, sati is the practice of mindfulness. This practice is often referred to as vipassana meditation, but that is the outcome. That is, the outcome is insights, right? Insights, a series of insights into one's own mind-body phenomena. So satipatthana, sati is the actual practice, not vipassana. Vipassana is the outcome. Vipassana means insight. So this practice of meditation doesn't really cover what Buddhists understand meditation to be. The Pali term for this practice is bhavana. Uh-huh. Bhavana. Bhavana means to develop some quality. Uh-huh. Now, we have samatha bhavana. Samatha means concentration. Uh-huh. One-pointedness or tranquility, various terms, right? So it is conceptual too. So perhaps meditation can mean that, but here we say samatha bhavana, so it's the development of calm, development of. We have metta bhavana. Metta is loving kindness, development of loving kindness, right? Development of, it's developmental. And then we have vipassana bhavana, which means development of insights, you see? So when we look at the types of meditation, they can be classified into two ways to meditate. It doesn't matter what technique you use or what tradition you go to, whether it's Theravada, Mahayana, or Vajrayana, whether you're using Christian techniques or Sufi or Hare Krishna chanting, Sufi dancing, you can classify pretty much everything that people call meditation, strictly, is based on concentration. Chanting, mantra, is a repetition that creates one-pointedness, because with concentration practices, they have a single object. It doesn't matter what that object is. It may be a visualization, it may be a repetition of a mantra or a phrase, it may be on the respiration. The effect actually is the mind becomes absorbed. You're inducing a state of calm, tranquility. Of course, the benefit is it stabilizes the mind, it settles the mind, and temporarily, one with concentration, the mind becomes wholesome. Therefore, you feel good. That's why it's very popular. People love it, you know. If you can see in this practice, the discipline is not imposed in any way. It's actually just discipline yourself to persevere, to sustain the practice, and then you will get the benefit. And with concentration-based practice, the benefit is serenity, calm, stability. But you've induced a state. That's all. It can be a very deep state. There's levels of it, as you might know. These meditation absorptions we call in Pali jhanas, very high levels of it. But still, that's all it is. It's a state. And we know that the Buddha, on his search for enlightenment, went to two teachers whose names I can never remember. But we know historically he went to two teachers to learn these higher levels of these jhanas or meditative absorptions. And when he had succeeded, the teachers then turned around and said to him, you more or less can take over. You've actually gone a higher level than we have, so you can take over. But the Buddha rejected that and said, no, this is not the way out of suffering. Because it's the whole Buddha's path. I know people get tired of hearing Buddha saying it's all about suffering, but it's not just about suffering. It's about to acknowledge the reality that it is, in fact, inherently suffering, unsatisfactory, stressful, that we know the cause of it. That's the hankering in the mind, the desire in the mind. And we know, and here, that it can be ended. It's not inevitable. And how to end the suffering? Through the practice path the Buddha gave, the Eightfold Path, both through the restraints in one's behavior to harmonize it, in one's relationships, in oneself. Okay, that's the base. And then to the meditation skills, which I've mentioned. And further on, that will lead to insights and wisdom and freedom for the mind. So the concentration-based practice are beneficial, most certainly, but they're not what the Buddha meant us to do. We need to do the mindfulness practice. I mean, the Buddhists have been know about this practice for centuries, over 2,000, many centuries, 2,600 years. But our Buddha's doing it very much. In fact, not very much at all. It was only in modern times in Burma that the practice was revived. What happens, even in Buddhist countries, is that people tend to default to samatha. I know in Sri Lanka, I practiced there in the forest tradition, happened to be in a monastery, in a forest monastery, where they combined them. But they combined them only because Mahasi Sayadaw, a modern Vipassana teacher, revived the practice in Burma. In all other Theravada Buddhist countries anyway, the practice had almost died out. Because Samatha, even for the forest monks who specialize in meditation and do nothing else, will go to Samatha. Because it feels good. When you do Vipassana meditation, you often have a lot of... It's a cleaning of the mind. It's a cleansing of the mind, right? So it's not so easy. A lot of the negative traumas and difficulties in minds will surface, you see. So it's very easy to suppress it, push it aside, you see. So... Okay, you've got the samatha, what we call samatha or tranquility, meditation based on concentration, which produces a state of mind of calm and tranquility. On the other hand, what the Buddha uniquely found, although he said he had rediscovered an ancient path, he never claimed it came down from heaven or he personally discovered, he had rediscovered, and that's important. So therefore, mindfulness is a universal. And that is why you'll find now in Western countries it's been taken up very much, not only in therapies, but all in the healing professionals. So this mindfulness is based on, it's an awareness practice. It's not concentration. It's not fixing your mind on a single object. And it has, so it has a different type of concentration. In concentration-based meditations, you have one object. As I've said, whatever. Visualization, the respiration, anapanasati, mantras, on and on. But in Vipassana, so it's one-pointedness. You fix on a single object. In, let's say, Satipatthana Vipassana, it is momentary concentration. You don't fix, you don't lock in, you don't hold, you don't suppress. You read the phenomena as it comes and goes, rises and passes away. So the concentration is what we call, use the Pali term, Kanika Samadhi, moment-to-moment awareness, not fixed. So you're able to read the experience and not just suppress it or react to it. So without suppressing it, without reacting to your experience, therefore it is a middle way. It's a middle path. You're not suppressing, skillfully or otherwise, nor are you reacting to the experience. So it's a middle path. You know, our minds tend to be bipolar. I mean, not clinically so, sure. But to some degree, we tend to either go, liking, disliking, you get high and low. We're constantly seesawing. We're more inclined to go from one extreme to the other. We tend to that without training. But with training, you can maintain this more equilibrium, equipoise, homeostatic balance of mind. And that comes with training. The Buddhist path is training. It is practice. It's not something you agree with or disagree with or think is a good thing. It's actually a training. The Buddha very many times always said, you must train yourself in this way. So it's a practice path. And what does practice mean? Practice is repeated performance to develop a skill. It requires application and effort and sustained application. It's not an easy thing to do. And that is the only discipline in the Buddha Dharma as a practitioner. The discipline is not something imposed on you by the teacher or anybody else. But you take it on yourself to practice regularly and sustain that practice, because it's developmental. Unless you practice, it won't develop. It's not suddenly you've been told some secret and now you understand it all. You've actually got to bring about transformation. And this is what they're finding in neurology, neuroscience at the moment. Many of the Buddhist approaches to working with the mind, mental culture, they're finding in neuroscience, in understanding that we're understanding more and more about the brain and how the brain itself can change itself. How? Through practice. If one part of the brain is malfunctioning or is damaged, for instance, if you had a stroke, you, through the practice, through the training, you can, to some extent, if you can apply yourself, you can revive, if not that area of the brain that's been damaged, but another part of the brain will then come into be functioning again. This is what neuroscience is finding. And this is what you're doing as a Buddhist Vipassana meditator. In fact, I just picked up an article off the internet a couple of days ago that said they'd done a study of quite a large study of students who practice Vipassana for a month, and they found that the physical brain, the synapses and the connect that the connections in the brain and the coverings of the neurons and so on and on had significantly increased with a month's practice only. So now the suggestion, why don't people use that to help them with their problems? And we know that. I mean, we didn't know at the Buddha's time people didn't understand the brain. But now we've got brain scanners, functional MRI scanners, that we can see what's happening in the brain as you practice. So you, as a Buddhist, you're on a practice path. Not just an academic or religious path or cultural path. To be a Buddhist, you're a practitioner. Mm-hmm. So the mindfulness meditation is the key. Now, it's not that it can be done surely at an intensive level under conditions which support the practice, but it also can be done. It can be brought into your daily life. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's only useful or can be practiced in a static cross-leg posture in a monastery or retreat center. It can be practiced out in your routine life. I can quote the Buddha who said, mindfulness is useful everywhere. Right? Now, people, as you are experiencing now, a lot of we're overloaded, overextended, stretched and stressed. People are just totally stressed out, you know, just to survive, just to keep yourself going and the family and everybody's stressed out. I don't exclude myself or all monks too. You know, so everybody's stressed. But how do you bring yourself and keep the mind clear and fresh? You know, what about some mental hygiene? Have you considered that? I mean, do you put the garbage out back home we put the garbage out, we sort it out, and the recycle and the compost and the just the general rubbish, we put that out once or twice a week. You do that? What do you do with your mind? No, we keep putting more stuff in it, more things, more stimulation. Even when we're supposedly relaxing, again we turn on the television or we go on the internet and we on and on it goes. We don't give ourselves any rest or allow ourselves to be quiet and clear the mind. But in mindfulness meditation, that is exactly what happened. If you practice a mindfulness technique, not just on the cushion, but also as you get around in your daily routine and daily life, because it's a dynamic practice, you only have to watch your mind states, your emotions, just be monitoring your mind states throughout the day. Very interesting. Without, of course, making any evaluation or judgment. Uh-huh. To be noticing your thinking. Rather than get lost in your fantasies and worries, and just be aware of the thinking, you know. If you let them run without any restraint, then they will take you over. Uh-huh. But critically, too, one should be noticing, as part of the mindfulness practice that the Buddha gave in his instructions, mindfulness of feelings. Mm-hmm. So what are feelings? Feelings here are not emotions, are quality, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Neither, that is, indifferent feelings. So if you watch your feelings in the day, I don't know whether you understand what I mean by feelings, you see. There's body sensations which are feelings. They can be pleasant or unpleasant. But there's also mental feelings, you see. So, and to know what feeling is present, you can ask yourself a check-in question. What am I feeling now? You know, we need to articulate to ourselves what is the feeling, pleasant or unpleasant. And we can know what the feeling quality is, the feeling tone, is whether we like something or dislike it. So we see something, we like it, so that of course there must be a pleasant feeling. We see something that's rotting in the gutter, for example. It's unpleasant. It may be unpleasant smell, unpleasant sight. Because what we're doing when we get around, we are creatures, beings in the sensory plane. Right? We're here in the sensory world, right? We're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching the five senses. There's also a sixth sense that was understood in early Buddhism, the intellect or the mind itself. Uh-huh. So these six senses, every time you see, smell, hear or touch and the mind is going, then there's contact. When there's contact, when there's a sense impression, there's consciousness, which is very instantaneous, but you can notice the feeling tone. What you see now, is it pleasant? You're looking at me and I'm looking at you. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? What you're hearing now, is it pleasant or unpleasant? I can see very hard or very sweet. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? So there's a feeling tone there. When you taste something, when you know something sweet, some chocolate I'm looking here at the table, it's sweet for sure. But it might be something sour and bitter, so that's unpleasant. See? So at all times, you're experiencing that. And what is happening? Feelings condition us. Liking, disliking. Uh-huh. It's part of the eight worldly winds, eight worldly conditions, right? They're pairs. Gain and loss. We're people in the world, especially lay people who have all their responsibilities, you're subject to the worldly conditions. Gain and loss. You gain, the flip side is you can lose. You're liking, and the other side of it, opposite, is disliking. People praise you. You're a brilliant talker. You're terrible. You're boring. I couldn't stand you. Okay, blame. Praise and blame. And now more and more people are presenting the Buddha Dharma, especially in Western countries, as the way to happiness. But, hold on a minute. Happiness? Well, yes. Happiness, but there's a flip side to happiness, unhappiness. You see? So between liking, disliking, gain and loss, praise and blame, and happiness and unhappiness, there's a middle path. We can maintain the middle path, which is the balance of the mind. We don't get caught up in being overexcited and overstimulated and happy, high, you know. Or do we get down low and get depressed and, you know, glass half empty, half full sort of thing? We can maintain balance, you know. Things are not always perfect, never will be. We accept that. Nor will they be, can we sustain any particular state? It's always changing. That's what the Dharma is telling us. Uh-huh. So if everything's changing, it has its positive side too, because we do not need to get stuck. Uh-huh. We can't get stuck. And we're not. One thing about the Buddha Dharma is that we be realistic. We accept the reality of life. Uh-huh. We accept that, you know, we need to actually train ourselves. And we can use the training, we can apply ourselves in a dynamic way into our ordinary, mundane, routine practice by noticing your mind states, your feelings, be monitoring your thinking. But also you can be beneficial, and I would suggest too, and tomorrow in our workshop we will go through, you need to have a daily practice, a sit, if you like, you know, to allow the mind to clear, to settle. If you don't do that, it all builds up. It's part of the mental health, you know, the mental purification that you allow a daily sit, a regular sit, and then as challenging as it is, and I'm not saying it's easy, you bring some mindfulness into your daily life, you know, and then you are actually on the path. Even just a little bit, very little, nothing special. You can't, we never can be 100% until we actually finally made the breakthrough. But even just a little bit of presence of mind in whatever you're doing, as you're doing it, you're going to have benefit. Uh-huh. You'll feel, you know, people think, oh, meditation is a selfish thing, people sitting there for hours, you know. But if you develop yourself, if you improve yourself in any way, you get some savvy, some insight, then we're all in relationship. We can't go off in the forest and pretend nothing's happening. We're all interrelated, interconnected. So therefore, by helping yourself, by developing yourself, getting some understanding, some wisdom, however little, then because we're in relationship, you're helping others. I can be a do-gooder, and I've been a do-gooder in my life. I've worked in hospices and all this sort of thing. But I know I've always felt better myself by helping others. See? So the Buddha said we must help. We develop ourselves, and then we help others. So that's all I've got to say. So if you've got any questions on what has been said this evening, thank you. If you ask questions, next lifetime, if you believe in it, you'll come back and you can join Mensa. You know Mensa? Only the top people, high intelligence, high IQ. So if you ask a question, you will be in a very unique group of high IQ, higher IQ. Yeah, that's the problem, actually. I've got a pamphlet here that says Seminar One Masters, Three Traditions of Meditation. And so there's so many techniques, so many offering. It's confusing. People just don't know where to start. If they start, they'll go from one to the other. Window shopping. Different techniques. I think you need to understand what I very briefly outlined this evening, what the types of meditation. It's like you go, you know, milk is milk, isn't it? Sure, there's a less fat milk and a light milk, and there's, sure, but it's still milk, right? It's often the different packaging, the different brands you're looking at. It's confusing, you know. So it's useful to understand technically what these two, there's only two types of meditation. Whether you want to do just samatha meditation, you just want to feel good, you want to feel calm, you want to stabilize the mind, and that's enough. And it's therapeutic, essentially you're after therapy, okay, that's enough. But if you want to go further on the Buddhist path, then you would go for some form of awareness practice. Awareness which would be, as I've been saying this evening, some sort of mindfulness. Even within the Vipassana tradition, there are quite a number of different techniques. Yeah, but you need to get some training. It's not that you just pick up some casual, dip through some casual reading, or you know, you hear about this or that. You actually need to go with a teacher. That would be number one. There was an exchange between the Buddha and his attendant and cousin Ananda. Everything we know, what the Buddha taught and said in the suttas. In historical suttas, Ewamme Sutang, I heard it this way. This is reportage from Venerable Ananda. Now, at one time, so if the Buddha was indisposed, Ananda would stand up there and give a discourse, explain the Dhamma to his audience. But he wasn't fully enlightened, we know. He only got through the first stage. Okay. So towards the end of his relationship with the Buddha, Ananda said, now I can practice myself. I know all about the Dhamma, his teaching. But the Buddha checked him. He said, not so, Ananda, unless you have a Kalyana Mitta, that is a mentor or teacher or guide, you cannot penetrate the Dhamma. So it's critical, unfortunately, you've got to find a teacher who at least he or she has travel experience more than you have. So if you have done no practice, well, that's not so difficult, but still you've got to work in tandem with a teacher. So that's the first thing. Whatever technique that teacher is teaching, well, that's how it is. You see, that's the most important thing. And that's quite a problem because there aren't very many real teachers. I personally have found I've been practicing since 74. Right? And for the first 10 years, I would say I did not know nothing. I got nowhere. One thing about myself, if I may say so, I'm a fairly persevering sort of type. I will hang in there regardless, if nothing else, But for the first 10 years, I came to realize I had known nothing. After 10 years of so-called practice, I've been to many teachers. I had done Zen practice. I had been to various, mostly Vipassana teachers. It was only when I went to Burma and met the masters there and worked. By that time, I thought I knew all about it. I suppose I might have done, But when I went to Burma, they said, they gave me some instructions. First, I said, simplistic, I know that, I've heard all that instruction. Sure, I heard about it, like a lot of people, but I never practiced it in any depth. I never had done sustained practice, just doing a very basic technique of mindfulness, sustaining that over. And I happened to be able to do that for 1 year at Mahasi's Center in Burma. That was my major practice for 1 year in Burma. And just by every day, 12 to 14 hours a day, which may sound a lot to you, but it isn't really. If that's all you're doing, 12, 14 hours a day is fine, you have your rhythms, you go up and down. But there's a teacher there. Every second day, you have an interview. In the Chan or the Zen tradition, I guess you have this teacher you relate, you're working in tandem with. You see? So that's how it works. Even at the Buddha's time, his disciples went to him as a teacher. Not to get a knowledge, but not just about the technical thing, but when they had done the practice, they reported their experience to their master. And that's how it goes. Unless you do that, you don't get anywhere, I tell you. It doesn't matter what you know about it, doesn't matter how many different techniques you've tried, unless you're prepared to work in tandem with it, somebody has had travel experience, you don't get anywhere. And that's what the Buddha said to Ananda. Even though he had all the knowledge, he had memorized everything the Buddha has said over those 45 years. And that's where we got the teachings from, Ananda, as reported. But the Buddha's telling him you won't make the breakthrough unless you have a teacher. So that's number one. So you've got to find a teacher. And then you work from there. Whatever that teacher's got to teach you. That's it. Any other questions? Definitely you'll get a high right cue. I'll guarantee you. Yes. I think it's more about lineage. It's not whether you like a person or even, I mean, one of my teachers, I didn't like him. And we had a bit of a struggle. And he whacked me a few times, not physically, but psychologically. And in fact, I appreciate that now. You know, I could have gone somewhere else, you know, I can't. What I would say, it's important too that you follow a lineage. Yes. Well, then you're attached to the teacher. That is not the practice. You're getting attached to some guru or some person, personality.
Sorry, I don't mean to...
No, you can. I'm happy if you do. The lineage has, you know, whether it's Chinese, say it was Chan or something, or Pure Land, right? So there is a lineage and there's technique there, right? So you would follow that, you would follow through. If that other lineage teachers would say a Vipassana from the Theravada tradition, they would not be doing... they'd be doing different techniques, say, let's put it that way. So why switch just because you felt you? I'm hearing you say, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question. You have a preference for while you're doing some particular practice, this other person comes along who you're more attracted to, who you affect, you would help you. But that lineage, say it would be Zen. It's, you know, there's many variations of how Zen is taught. You know, there's, I don't know the Chan, but I know in Japanese Zen, there's Soto and there's Rinzai. And there's variations of those too. So they would be very... the technique they'd be using, say in Rinzai, et cetera, be koans or the Shikantazen, whatever. So, you know, the teacher then has, you know, you were attracted to a particular teacher, but it's the same practice. You know, I can't really grasp what you're trying to say. You know? I'm not sure what you're saying. You're not shopping in the spiritual supermarket, are you? I mean, you can push a trolley around and some very attractive packaging, but I find it's essentially the same stuff inside the package, whatever the presentation is, whether it's Vajrayana, Mahayana, Theravada. Yeah, well... All my time, I've pretty much been on the Vipassana path. But within that tradition of different teachers, some teachers I got on very well with, compatible with. Others gave me a tough time, but I still stayed with them because I benefited in some ways. And what I find in the Mahasa tradition, while there's the basic technique is, different teachers within the same lineage or tradition will emphasize different aspects of that practice. And that's what I found useful. So I started off with Sadhu Pandita, Sadhu Lat, and then who is very much into very tough rise and fall. Then I moved into Sadhu Lakhan, who was more open and allowing. Then I actually spent more time with Chamye Sadhu, Sadhu Ujjanika, who was much more emphasizing mindfulness and daily activities. And there's other teachers there, Chittanupassana, Shwevamin Sayadaw, who teaches something more like a Zen practice of just knowing only the mind knowing the mind, the consciousness. And then this, you know, in the Burmese tradition, in the same practice of mindfulness, there is also, who's come very popular, Paul Sayadaw, who does the classical Vasudhi Marga model, first doing Samatha, Jhana, then into off you go. So there's a whole range of things, but it's essentially within the same lineage. And there's so many different teachers who emphasizing, not on the same track, but emphasizing different aspects of the path. But don't fall in love with a teacher, you know, because they're not. A Buddhist teacher is a Kalyanamitta, you know. If he's sour and heavy with you, that's fine too. If he's all sweet and nice, it doesn't make any difference, you know. Because you've got to look at your own. Mental hygiene from a practice point of view is that in mindfulness, it's very much how you relate to your experience, right? So when the material comes up in the mind, thinking, emotions, mind states, then you simply register that. It's like bare attention. You're just registering the material that comes to mind, as thoughts, as emotions. We're simply registering from moment to moment, nothing more, without reacting one side on the other, without suppressing. See, the problem with samatha is, while it actually, in effect, suppresses. Skillful, yes. But with sati, the quality of sati is non-interference. From a state of receptivity, you're simply witnessing the thinking, the emotions, without reaction. Or if you react, you know there's a reaction. So that allows a ventilation process that's clearing the mind. Of course, in deep intensive practice, you have the opportunity that the mind will naturally quieten, that the mind, the thinking will slow down, and the preoccupations one has naturally, you know, your business and all the rest of it, will naturally quieten, and there's no or very little input. You're not being stimulated as you would normally be. So in a retreat context, under those conditions, you're not speaking, so you're not engaging any conversation, you're not stimulating, getting stimulated in a way, living a very simple lifestyle. So the mind, the surface content of the mind, because we're caught up in the content of the mind, aren't we? If I ask you, you know, if you're not thinking, what's happening, it becomes a puzzling question, because we're constantly caught up in our internal dialogue, discursive thought, you know. We're constantly caught up in our emotions. You know, we live in the content of the mind. That's our reality. 99% of people, that's what's happening. We're living in the content, right? We're making our own movies and Okay, but once you get into practice, a lot of that preoccupations will naturally quiet. There's very little or no input. So you go down into the deeper levels of the mind, and the dormant or latent material will tend to surface. What is critical then, that you don't play back into it. And that is because what will happen then, there will be a discharge, a ventilation. That's what I mean by mental hygiene. Even not on that such a deep level, but even in a general way, that the stuff that you've been gone through since you woke up this morning, all the stuff in school or work or getting around or going shopping and doing your business, you're still playing with that in your mind, yeah? You're so conditioned that even as you go to sleep, off it'll go around, the next morning up it comes again. And, you know, you have no rest. You're not allowing the mind to ventilate, to clear, discharge. But if you did a daily sit, nothing more than just sitting and watching, witnessing the stuff, without reacting, without playing back into it, then that material is going to slowly clear. And you'll find, as a meditator, I don't go around all day, and I love being out in the bush and in the nature, because that's a natural way to do it. you know, naturally the mind becomes quiet, and you have got the skill just to accept things as they are, and they float out and they go away, and you do not get, you're not, the mind is not generating more stuff. It's not making constant associations. If the mind is overfull, it needs release. What it does, it fantasizes. It needs release from the pressure, so it fantasizes. They've done studies of showing monitoring people's brain activity, and it's constant every 10 so minutes, people just go off into a fantasy, and they're on half the time. Most people, a lot of the time, are on autopilot. We function. I mean, a lot of what we do in the day, it's possibly necessary, but we're not present. We're not present with what we're doing as we're doing it. We're on autopilot, and we're just walking around like zombies. I mean, not you people, of course. You know, so we're only living half a life. We're not really there with what's happening. We're preoccupied with what happened in the past. We're worrying or concerned or projecting what's going to happen. You know? Can we just be here? We can't be here because we're constantly caught up in the preoccupations. This comes down to, we're displaced persons. We're not here at all. I hope you've been here this evening, even if I bored you a little, you know. You know, after 5 minutes, when a speaker gives a speech or talk, people check them out. There's nothing, they just go to sleep, thinking about other things. If you've done any chanting, you see the same thing. Once you've got used to doing the chanting, you can be chanting away, which seems quite involved chanting, and your mind's somewhere else. Thinking about something, you've just gone off in a daydream, you see. But when you become more alert and present, and you become more receptive and open, and things don't stick so easily, you know. One of the, you know, we talk about why we suffer, you know, the cause of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha said the cause is this hankering, these urges in the mind. Now, allowing a certain biological urges in the mind, you know, for food and other things, but it was also this hankering in the mind that comes from all these different urges. And what you find in Vipassana meditation, we call it surfing the urges. All these urges come up, but we're aware of them, but we don't play them out. Uh-huh. We just, like, even physical urges. It's a sort of trivial example. If you have an itch in the body, right, and you're sitting in a cross-legged posture, and there's an itch, and you would normally, automatically, unknowingly, unconsciously, relieve the itch. You know, it's itchy there, it's itch. But as a Vipassana meditator, you'd be sitting in a formal posture, and you feel this irritation on the skin. Instead of impulsively moving to relieve the irritation, you're aware of the irritation, but more importantly, you're aware of the urge in the mind to relieve it. If you can tolerate that urge without playing it out, without acting on it, then you're starting to get at the very, very deep conditioning of this desire in the mind. Yeah? You're deconditioning. You're, okay, it's just an urge. It comes and goes, you know. If you can work with, say, physical urges in the body like that, then you start to look at urges in the mind, you see? The desire that's causing the problem, causing your own suffering. So what happens in mental hygiene or mindfulness is that there is a clearing of the mind. Much comes through. I mean, for most people, majority of people, quite difficult material might surface in the mind. Old traumas, so it's very important, critical indeed, how you relate to your experience. You have to be open and accepting. If it's very difficult, it's very difficult. That's fine. It's unpleasant, it's unpleasant. It's critical. And in that way, slowly, slowly, these urges, these hankerings of the mind have less hold on you. You're clearing the mind. You're freeing yourself. Mm-hmm. You're deconditioning yourself. You're getting some insights. You're maintaining more balance of mind. You know, the seven factors of enlightenment, which are the outcomes of the practice. It's always based on mindfulness. Mm-hmm. That's why it's a core teaching in the Buddhist tradition. Mindfulness with investigating, that's experientially knowing the character, specific characteristics of the mind and body, the phenomena of mind and body. Okay. It goes through of maintaining the intensity of effort, and it brings out joy. Actually, there's joy in the practice. But it's non-sensuous joy, you know. It's not all horror and difficult. There's joy in the practice. But we can go right through and there's peace in the mind, sure. But the maturity factor in the Bojangas or the enlightenment factors that come out of the practice is equanimity, equipoise, homeostatic balance. That is the maturity factor in the practice. You find even in the Brahma Viharas, you know, there's equanimity. You go through a series of meditations. So equanimity comes when the mind is more clear and balanced. Not some, you know, dramatic explosion in the mind that you're enlightened, but just this equipoise and balance of mind. So there can be difficult situations and conditions, and there can be very pleasant conditions, but you're not getting overbalanced, you're not getting overexcited or attached to something, or not you're going to get or there's difficult things, you accept it as it is, you know, and don't get too disheartened or downcast or depressed. So that is the most valuable thing you can do in practice, is do this very basic mindfulness technique. To me, it's all, the Buddha said, as I said before, mindfulness is useful everywhere. At all levels, in your daily life or in intensive retreats. Yeah, I think you've got to set yourself up to do it. So the question is, how do you develop the habit, you know? You've got to set yourself up to do it. I mean, it's not just enough to have good intentions, you know. You've heard the saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So it's not just good intentions. It is, you've got to physically set yourself up. And I would say you've got to base yourself in the body. Mm-hmm. In the four Satipatthanas, the four areas of attention, you start off with the body. There's some traditions that start off with the mind. You know, unless you're very high-level practitioner, it doesn't work that way. For most people, you've got to start looking at the body. At the moment, I'm just sitting. I'm blah, blah in a way. Hope you don't mind too much. But I also know I'm sitting. See? All this evening, I've been feeling the touch. So while I'm being blah, 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 I know I'm here. I'm in the body. I'm not, you know, in some rarefied state of mind. I'm here in contact with the body, touch. So I find that a very useful thing. There's not any time during the day or any situation, you're in a meeting, that you're not in the body. And a lot of people don't find, are not really grounded in the body. So I do a daily sit. Like this morning, I sat, as I do every morning. If I'm traveling, I still sit. So that allows me, and my first focus is on the body, the sitting touch. It's become a habit, and it's a good habit, and it's necessary to establish. What is an interesting that they've done a study. I can't quote you exactly where I read this study, but they say it takes you 3 months, whatever you're doing. And I did start. I used to do hatha yoga a long time ago, and I thought I'd try it again, but it was a bit half-hearted attempt. Partway through, I stopped doing it. Anyway, but they said if I had continued practice for 3 months, by that time you get into a feedback loop. After 3 months, even at from time to time you feel there's resistance in establishing some practice, say here it's meditation, a daily sit. Any time you break, you know, you weaken and you say, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, or it's not good quality time. You've just got to sit, make the habit. You fake it. Even if it's not doing anything, you sit there and you're not doing anything, all the mind's everywhere, don't worry. Just sit, because you've got to maintain the habit for at least 3 months. Within 3 months period, if you maintain that practice, whatever the quality of it, not to be concerned about the quality, then it will be established as a habit. You've conditioned yourself. This is what a recent psychological study, I'm into reading up on all this latest research on the brain and the mind. And that's, so 3 months is a period you've got to say, next 3 months, regardless what happened, I'm going to sit there every day. And even if I'm traveling, I sit on my bed when I'm traveling. I wake up, I won't go anywhere else. I won't go into the bathroom. Immediately I'll sit up on my bed and I'll sit. Don't go out. Once you go out, you can lose it. Somebody will call you, or you'll get involved in something. Always sit on the bed, or at home. I sit in this in the monastery. Every morning we sit at the same time in the same place. And even if I don't feel like it, I'll just walk in there and do it, you know. And that's how you can maintain the habit. But I think the meditator needs to be body-based, right? So just to go off into some technique that takes you out of the body is not helpful. Mm-hmm. Because you're not grounded. You can easily... There's some techniques in Chittanupassana or Zazen, Sikantasana, when it's just knowing only, consciousness. Well, you know, it's too subtle, you know. We're not so refined. We're not so... We need to be very physically based. So I find that practical... Because even when I get up and move around, I know I'm touching. Unless I'm jumping for joy or in fright, I'm always you're always in contact with something. Uh-huh. So there seems to be a time you need to sustain the practice, which it's been found to be 3 months minimum. And you've got to make a commitment. And another way to, if you have problems with making commitment, okay, you've decided you're going to be meditating every day. One way is to tell everybody. Tell your family and friends, I'll be meditating, see? Now, one of the... you tell everybody you're meditating and they'll say to you, how's the meditating going? Yeah, it's good, eh? Oh, no, yeah, sort of. And then you'll... Okay, I better... You can't get away from you. You know, you've told everybody... Best thing to do is to tell them to come and watch you meditate. You know, sit there and they come and have a look at you, you know. So they'll check you out. Then for sure you're stuck. You have to do it. Haven't you? You can't get embarrassed if you tell them you haven't been meditating. Oh, yes, I've been meditating. So eventually that's to make a... let everybody know. And then... I mean, there's other ways you can join a group. There's lots of, I don't know about here, but in Western countries, a lot of little groups, there may not be a centre, but they have there is a group here too, that you would join some group. So you're with like-minded people who will do the same thing. If you do it at home, it might be to do it with a group, regular, even usually it's a one day a week type of thing, sit. At least it may be partially social, that's good too. But you join a group, and so some people, that's all they ever do. They can't do it at home, you know. But it's important that you establish the habit and sustain that habit. So, but the most difficult thing, actually, though, is to do it on the fly. You know, when you're busy. That is a challenge, you know. If you've had some formal training, I think it possibly be easier. But I know a lot of people who do formal retreats, like 10-day retreats or longer, once they walk out the door, it's gone. I know. I've done it myself too, but, you know, it took me a long time to sort of, you know, it's just how the mind works. You know, you said, been there, done that. I just want a bit of rest, and you give yourself a break. No, it's no breaks. You allow that sometimes you can do it full on. Other times you can just do a very light, you know. If you can maintain, that's why in a retreat, what's most valuable is to maintain a thread of awareness throughout the day. At times, I mean, we've got our own biorhythms, you know. Sometimes we're going full out. Other times we're down, you know. But even when you're down, or it might also have a lot to do with your metabolism. But anyway, you've got to allow that you have your ups and downs all the time. For some reason, people are quite rigid. They, especially Westerners, have to be 100% all the time. It's impossible, you know. Sometimes you're low and up and down. But you still, even if it's only a tentative awareness, you know, at least you're aware that you're not aware. One of the definitions, or the original meaning of sati, was to remember. And the Buddha sort of put another meaning to it, is to be more attentive, you know, to be present. Not just to remember as in memory, but also to be present, be attentive, to pay attention, maintain your attention, be attentive. So, but in the sense of remembering, you've got to remember to be remembering, to be mindful. And the one trick is to use some device. I don't know how familiar you are with sort of the Pavlovian conditioning, you know, where the dog was given a... sown some food, and when he saw the food, he given a reward, and he salivated. And so you're able to condition the dog. When you just saw a picture of the food, it turned him on. Anyway, if you find you condition yourself in some way. For instance, if every time you handle water. How many times during the day you're washing your hands, you're washing the floor, you're washing the dishes, you're washing the dog, you're washing the cat? Well, you wouldn't wash the cat. But, you know, at all times, you know, and that would trigger an association to be present. You can condition yourself. So that's another sort of way of finding something that would remind you. Or you could say within every hour, you would say that I would then check, do it, give yourself a check-in question. Where am I now? What's happening? You know, what's my feeling? In every hour, on the hour, say, you would ask yourself a check-in question. What am I feeling? Where am I now? What's, you know, check this mind state. And you'll start to notice become more present. Another good way is to review at the end of the day, right? We got all this stuff we go through, all these experiences, all these interactions and relationships and things that happen throughout the day. It all sort of builds up, and you know, and you push it aside and go to sleep. But I'm suggesting at the end of a day, you would review what happened during that day. It's a very good practice. You know, from the time you woke up, in a general way, what happened during the day, without, of course, evaluating or making judgments. You know, we're not saying good, bad, or indifferent. We're not judging ourselves. Or we don't have any expectations. So without evaluating or making judgment, if you review yourself, or like the Venerable here makes a diary, you know, say a meditation diary, you will start to be noticing the patterns, your own behavior patterns, and, you know, how are you related to this situation or that situation. Yeah? And that, in a common sense way, would suggest if every time you get in a relationship and something, you know, you get upset about something because of this or that, then you'll start to notice patterns in your behavior, patterns in how you relate to things. And I always would say, if you can see patterns in your behavior during the day, I'm sure in common sense way, things will suggest yourself, well, I'm not going to get back into that situation again. You will start to notice, and therefore you could see perhaps ways of dealing with those situations they would suggest themselves, I'm saying, in a common sense way, if you start to see the patterns of your behaviour during the day. Of course, the difficulty is there's a tendency to judge them. So if the negative things come up in your daily relationships and things, then, you know, next, you, then you say, oh, you, then you, at least you've become aware of it. Uh-huh. And so you can make up strategies not to get caught, because we're creatures of habit, essentially, aren't we? You know, we function a lot on just autopilot. So we'll start to get more conscious, and we not carry so much with us, and that's good mental hygiene. And we will not. I don't know where you understand the word hassle. Do you have that term, hassle? Sort of slang word. So you don't hassle yourself. If you're not hassling yourself, you're not bothering other people either, you know. So everybody benefits if you have a bit of, you know, you'd be more considerate. You won't make the same conditioned habitual mistakes So there's a lot to be, there's a lot of value in to oneself and one's relationship in being more present. Even minor insights. It's not going to be great, massive, transformational insights. You know, you get a lot of psychological insights of your own behavior by monitoring your life and reviewing it at the end of a day. In Sri Lanka, they have meditation diaries, you know. They've got very nice-looking diaries, gold-embossed, my meditation diary. If you're a writer and you make notes, it's very interesting what it will reveal to you by making a diary of your practice. Because we experience so much, but you lose it all, doesn't it? It just becomes foggy, sort of vague. I think for most people, I would think the first thing is a good time. If people have very worked all day, to do formal meditation would be difficult. You know, it's like having you've been very busy, now you've got to put the brakes on and sit. What I find more strategically, if you're going to do at the end of a busy day, is to do walking meditation, right? Or walking naturally back and forth until the mind naturally quiets, and then sit. More likely, you're likely to do a sitting meditation when you're rested, you know, morning. But, I mean, it depends on the person. But what you'll find, initially often, that there's resistance, initial resistance, right? Until you become practiced, until you get into the feedback loop where you're getting, you know, you actually almost become addicted to it, then there's often initial resistance. Mm-hmm. But if you're prepared just to sit there and not, you said when you're feeling weak or tired, you still must sit as a Vipassana meditator because you watch that. Even if you're sleepy, you don't allow yourself to sleep, of course, but you focus on the state of sleepiness as best you can. If you're really feeling sleepy, just go to bed. I mean, go to sleep. Go for a nap, you know. That's a common sense thing. But often you can penetrate a sleepy state. You can break through a sleepy state. But anyway, you do it regardless of that. If you're feeling weak, well, you're just feeling weak, and you observe the weakness, you know. If you're feeling sick, well, you watch the sickness because you're watching feelings, unpleasant feelings. Very interesting. And often there's a mind state, right? It's not just a mind state present. There's resistance there too in the mind. You know, there's a tension that the mind state has created. There may be, it's very interesting to watch when you sit, be checking yourself constantly, the body state. Is there any contractions, you know? Because a lot of the mental stuff has been expressed in the body, and the body clamps up, the body contracts. There's tension in the body. But if you just watch the body sensations without doing anything, you're not trying to relax or do anything with it. You just be with the tension, just observe it. It changes. There's no resistance. Everything moves and changes. If you're doing Vipassana meditation, you find everything's flowing and moving and changing. If you're stuck, there's resistance. Mm-hmm. So you just stay there with it. With mindfulness, it's a non-interfering observation of the experience. Mm-hmm. Nothing more. If you're sick, well, you look at, if you've got a cold, good, that's great. Good way, just watch it. And you find half of the unpleasant feeling of cold is it resisting, you want it to go away. You're fighting it. But if you accept it, if you're open to it, allowing it, it's not as bad as it can be, you know, usually. Not that bad anyway. Because you're resisting it, you know. You're fighting it. So you'll find in practice that when you're on the ball, things are changing and moving. If you're stuck, you just observe the stuckness. In fact, that's the blessing of it. You don't need to get stuck. And you don't hassle yourself. And that's another real benefit. So what the Buddha said, I'd say in final thing, okay, there's suffering, and we know why, and it can be the end of it. Suffering is not necessary. That's the central message of the Buddha. Suffering is not necessary. If you suffer, you're stupid. I'm sorry, you're stupid. It's stupid suffering. You don't need to suffer. You haven't got the savvy, the insight. You're causing your own suffering. It's unnecessary. Anyway, yeah.